want to welcome back listeners who have heard the first segment of our conversation with Alan Snyder, United States Air Force retired, on his perspectives of leadership. Al continues by telling how he prepared himself for what was to become a significant career of leadership in the military. So let's pick up where we left off.
We've all been answerable to someone in our lives, being supervised by others. Some of those people we've liked and some we didn't. How was that for you, Al, in your early years in the Air Force?
Well, Rod, I call it, for lack of a better term, I call it my list of things. And mostly, I've always thought of my list of things as the things not to do when I become a leader was longer than the other list, which was the things that I want to do when I'm a leader. I suppose they equaled out in length. I never really counted them, but I didn't realize when I was a young airman, or even in my second career, when I was first at an entry-level job in the credit and collections industry, I didn't realize how much subconsciously I was taking note of things that were happening, watching people do their jobs, watching bosses and supervisors, and the way they conducted business, and kind of mentally putting onto my to list of things to do or things not to do, things that I saw supervisors do that were good and I wanted to emulate, and things that they did that were bad and I just cringed, and I thought, ooh, I am never going to do that when I get to be the boss. And so You tend to have these things because you're going to emulate people that you admire and respect, and you're going to shy away from doing things that you thought were just very wrong. Many times you're the one who experiences that directly. Other times you just see it happening and you observe it and you know that's wrong. It's not the way you should do things. And so, you know, an example of what I'm talking about here. And these things didn't come to my mind until I was brought into the world of leadership, which incidentally I came into screaming and kicking and dragging my feet because I wanted to be a technician and a very good one all of my military career. And, of course, it was only when they explained to me at about 12 years service that I certainly could continue to be a technician, but if I'd ever like to be promoted again, it would be wise to become a supervisor of technicians doing the same job. Then I could help train them, I could lead them, and I would grow as well. So I was a reluctant boss, but as it turned out over the years, it worked out very well for me. And it was when I was first put in charge of this one small unit that had six people that I began to realize that there were a whole list of things that I knew I wasn't going to do and things that I should be doing. And an example of that would be, I'm sure you've all been present at one time or another. You may have been the one who was the focus of the tirade or whatever, but you've been in a public workplace and, you know, the boss comes out, singles out some individual and launches into a royal rear end chewing for something that they've done, some deed that they've either messed up, done improperly, or forgot to do, whatever the mistake they've made, they're going to get publicly reamed right there because that's what the boss thinks he's supposed to do, or at least he's not thinking, but he's just doing it. So right in public, in front of everybody, he launches into a real rear-end chewing. Most people will just cringe. They'll be embarrassed for the individual. They'll want to walk away from it. They'll want to be almost anywhere but there as the other person gets chewed out. And this is where it goes on your list. If you're embarrassed by the behavior of the individual doing it, it'll go right onto your list unconsciously or subconsciously, and that is, I am not ever going to do that because it's just way too embarrassing to the individual. They immediately, upon finding out they're under attack, they're going to instinctively go into, figuratively speaking, they're going to go into a defensive crouch, and they're going to defend themselves, and they're not going to be listening effectively because they're under attack, and it's humiliating and embarrassing because other people are right there to witness it. So remember this then from that, if nothing else, and that is when you're going to criticize somebody, unless there's some very good reason for doing it in a timely fashion in the public, you should darn well criticize in private. The converse of that, of course, is that when you praise in public. It's common sense, but you would be surprised how many people just leave that and forget about it entirely. So I'm going to encourage you not to do that. I can give you an example on the to-do list. I witnessed this about maybe 13 years into the service. It was a clash of what I kind of thought of as titans at the time. I had not come to be a chief. In fact, I was a long ways away from that. And I had certainly a serious degree of respect for chiefs as the highest enlisted rank. And so I thought chiefs pretty much couldn't do anything wrong. But in the military world, of course, all enlisted people are junior to officers. And I worked in a shop where there were four of us on one particular task. And at 2 o'clock every afternoon, our commander, a full colonel, would come out. And he would look at the product that we were working on. He would make comments about whether he thought progress was going well. It was a theoretical thing, and we'd have some good give and take discussions. And hopefully all of us would grow from his knowledge. He was a PhD as well as a full colonel, so he knew a lot of what he was talking about. Anyway, on this particular occasion, I and three of my workmates were busy working on a product. And one of the workmates was a chief, and the other two were, I think, GS-12. So we had people here with more time in service, more rank, and more experience on the job than I had. So even though I was a master sergeant at this time, I was junior to these guys. I was busy in the learning mode. And the colonel came out, looked at our product, and made a comment to the chief about how he thought some particular aspect of this job should be done a little bit differently, and that he noted that perhaps was the second or third time he'd seen the chief do that particular thing as opposed to doing it the way the colonel thought it should be done. I was taken aback because suddenly the chief stood up. We were working with grease pencils and rags at the time. He threw down his pencil and threw down his rag, looked at the colonel, and said, "I don't have to take this crap. I have been doing this job. I have 26 years of experience. I know how to do this job." And he got all huffy about it. That could have been handled rather dynamically, because the colonel certainly outranked him, and it could have gotten ugly. But this was a to-do. It went on my to-do list because I watched the colonel look at him, and he said, "Well, let me disabuse you, chief, of one idea or one thought you just voiced there. I don't believe you have 26 years of experience, chief. And that's why we're having this conversation about how you're doing your job. I think that you have 1 year of experience 26 times. Now, if you think about that, there is a heck of a difference between 26 years of divergent or diverse experience, kind of making a more complete person of you. But if all you're doing is the same thing over and over and over, and you're not growing or bringing any other experience into your work life, or for that matter, your personal life, then you aren't really growing as much." And I thought he handled it very smoothly because he never angered. He didn't take it as disrespect, even though it probably was borderline. And he just simply explained to him how he felt and left the chief to think about that. And I certainly noted it because here we are, 30 or 35 years later talking about that very episode, which happened clear back in the probably mid-1970s. So you've got a list of things to do. You're going to emulate the things that good leaders do that you've seen them do, because that's what your mind automatically goes to when you want to be a good leader. And you're going to not do, hopefully, some of the things that you saw others do, and you thought, oh my gosh, I don't ever want to do that when I get to be the boss. So you're going to praise in public, and you're going to criticize in private. And hopefully those thoughts will stick with you for many years to come and serve you well.
Well, in getting others to follow you, you've talked a lot about equity. Tell us more about that.
Well, I guess I've chosen the term equity, Rod, because in my experience, there have been a number of jobs, even when I went into it as an experienced leader, where I didn't have what I thought was all of the knowledge to succeed or to solve a particular problem or handle a particular issue. And I always felt that it was necessary to get input from others. And those others might have been peers, they might have been superiors, but most times it was those who were my followers, because they're the ones that are doing the actual work. They have hands on the controls, and they're going to know more about the job than you do in terms of the nuts and bolts. So I've always felt like I didn't have all the answers. Probably some of that goes back to the inferiority complex I developed early on in my life and had to try to overcome ever since. But I just never felt like going into any situation that I knew everything. I always felt like there was more I should know, and I wasn't averse to asking people at all. That was a good thing. Because when we talk about building equity in your leadership, remember, whatever your plan is for how you're going to lead your people, what projects you're doing, what the product is that you're going to come out with in the end, whatever your plan is, there's a difference between your plan and our plan, or even their plan. And by that I mean your plan has little or no equity built into it by your followers, because it's simply your plan. If it fails, that's no skin off their nose, because it was your plan. Of course it failed. But if it's their plan, developed by them, implemented by them, even with your guidance, there's a heck of a lot better chance for success, because they've got all kinds of equity in that plan. It's theirs. They don't want to see it fail. So to the extent that you can include input from your people into developing some particular plan, whether it's a change in an operation you're doing, change in policy, whatever, include them to the extent that you can. And if they're competent and they're capable people who can do the job, if nothing, let them do the whole darn thing. Just oversee it. Approve it in the end. Give a thought or two on improving it here and there as it's being developed. But let it be entirely their plan, and just one that when they got to the rollout point, you just sprinkled a little holy water on it and called it done. That will be theirs. They will have tremendous amount of equity in it, and they will make it succeed or die trying, because they may not care whether your plan succeeds, but they sure care whether theirs does. And an example of that, in 1981, I was assigned to a very big production division of an organization. I was a chief at that time, a new chief, just had put it on put the rank on. And my boss was a full colonel, a division chief. And I remember the first conversation I had with him. He was a very direct man, and he said, "Chief, I don't have time to mess around. One of the problems with this division is we got 312 people out here doing jobs, and I can't find any certification on any of them. I don't know who's trained in any of the 7 work centers. I don't know who's competent in what function. I don't know if I have anybody cross-trained. I have a miserable training program. Make a new one. Develop it, and it better work." And that was the extent of the guidance that I got. Well, to me, I went back to my office and sat down and thought about it and decided, okay, I have nowhere near the knowledge to develop a actual training program that includes cross-training and certification of performance at levels, et cetera, et cetera. What I do know is that there are people out there working on the production floor, as we referred to it then. There are three teams of 72 people each, plus there are some peripheral organizations in there too, but there's three big production teams. Each one of them has their own bosses. There are very knowledgeable people running these teams, and these people would be the ones who would have the knowledge of how to put together a new training program. I simply had an idea, and I pinned out some thoughts on we have to have a certification process, we have to have a cross-training process, we have to have documentation. The minimum things that would need to be in this new training program. So I just looked at the key players in the organization, looked at who had the best reputations, and I selected about, I probably selected 10 people total, called them into a meeting and said, we are going to redo the entire training program and make it more effective. And so here's the things that we need to be able to certify. From that point, they came back to me within about 3 days, and they said, we're going to set up a system where new people coming into the jobs or anybody moving into any job will be known as an apprentice, and after they become certified, they will become a journeyman, and eventually, if they get to a certain level of experience and skill in this job, they will be called a master. But we'll have basically an apprentice and journeyman situation here, and they'll be certified in writing on each of those steps. And they'll be certified on the various jobs in each of the 7 work centers as time permits and as they show potential for it. As it turns out, the plan developed beautifully. I think it took us about 3 weeks total based on time being expended just trying to find a meeting time when everybody working different shifts could get together and work on it. But the plan was developed when I had some input to it and some guidance, but basically I just let them run with the plan. And when it came time to roll it out, they handed it to me, and I said, no, I'm not going to roll this out. This is your plan. You're going to brief it. And I went and got the colonel. He came in and sat down, and he listened to their entire briefing, offered a thought or two, asked a question or two, and said, wow, sounds good. Let me know how it goes. And that was it. Now, I thought this was all just a good project. I felt good about it. The outcome seemed to be good, and I thought that kind of closed it out. However, a day or two later, the chief who was in the organization who had preceded me in the job that I had came into my office kind of hot under the collar, and he said, I hear you're rolling out an entire new training program. Why are you doing that? I developed a complete training program for this division 3 years ago. I rolled it out, and they put it into effect, and it was a good program. And I said, well, apparently that program fell apart, wasn't embraced, didn't get implemented properly or something, because it has fallen into disarray. And my boss said, there better be a new one, and it had to have all of these things. And he said, well, yours is going to fail too then, because mine was good and it failed. And I said, I really don't think mine will fail because it's not mine. It's theirs. They developed it. They had all the input to it. They briefed it to the boss. He approved it. I'm sure this is going to go just fine because they won't let it fail. They have way too much invested in it. And, you know, as it turned out, of course, it was a good plan. For as far after that period of time, I was in service for another 9 years, and I know that plan in its original form was still working 9 years later when I retired. So that's an example. just remember this. Your people are going to determine your success or failure as a leader. If they decide they don't like you as a leader, they don't respect you, you don't give them a participative role, you do things that they don't think are that professional or inclusive of them, etc., they may not consciously make the decision for you to fail as a leader, but that will prevail out there, and you will regret having not taken care of your people. So make sure as you go along that since they're responsible for your success or failure, that you take care of them and make sure that they get a say in the planning and the implementing of things. It's going to go a lot better for you.
Thanks for joining us in our second segment of our conversation with Al Snyder. His concept of building equity with his team is a great one. Perhaps you already have an application in mind in your own work life. We invite you back for our third and final segment where Chief Al talks to us about leadership style and the conditions that determine the most important approach to leadership. Finally, Al draws a connection to the basics of leadership to statements made over 2,000 years ago. So please join us.